impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Precognitive
dissonance.
wasn't too loud, was it?
no, almost perfect. Hello and good evening, everyone.
I'm Smiles Lewis.
I'm Craig York, coming to you through the miracle of modern technology. It's Precognitive Dissonance. At our new time, same bad day, 8 o'clock in the evening.
8 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time here on AnomalyRadio.com and podcast, as always, at PrecognitiveDissonance.com. Yeah, it's good to be back, man. It's been weeks and weeks and weeks.
Indeed, but we're here, and we've got a show. It's, oh, my heavens to Betsy. All kinds of interesting things popping up in the news. Everything from a crypto-archaeological, actually a bit of conventional archaeology, or actually geology, that sort of turns the notion of where we came from in North and South America on its head.
Oh, yes.
An extensive and rather complicated article on synthetic pot as a military weapon.
Yeah.
I got to that page and I was surprised at the depth of the article. We'll get back to it in a little bit, but if you want to go ahead and look it up, it's www.alternet.org/drugreporter/92049.
Synthetic pot as a military weapon? Question mark. Meet the man who ran the secret program. Yeah, that's one was thankful to find posted in the Rigorous Intuition forums. And having researched things like the military's use of or experimentation with various drugs, including LSD and other psychedelics, and of course the CIA's MK Ultra programs, it's like, no surprise, but I hadn't really ever heard that much talked about in terms of pot. But I guess over the years you hear these, you know, folk tales and urban legends about killer weed.
Was it shown to be actually lethal?
No,
I got the impression it's incredibly long lasting.
Right, yeah, no. I just couldn't
Oh yes, I'm
resist the pun, sorry.
Well, no, and I'm old enough to remember Chevy Chase's classic "Send Us Your Killer Marijuana" on Saturday Night Live. But anyway, the thing that has me not bugging my eyes out, but at least cocking eyebrow, is an interview with a former Apollo astronaut and Moonwalker, Edgar Mitchell.
Yeah, this is the founder of the IONS, Institute of Noetic Science. It's headquartered out in California, and that's been pioneering in a lot of alternative medicine, mind-body relationship, parapsychological stuff. He has connections to the founding of the remote viewing program that was a partly military program that was going on at SRI, Stanford Research Institute, back in the 70s, he's been saying, and more or less what's, I think, in this article for some time in various, you know, less overt ways, and in fact, in the last couple of years, there was a message going around saying that he was about to make some big announcement regarding just such a supposition that the United States government or human agencies on this planet have been in contact with beings.
Yeah, he pretty much states it baldly. This was, I gather, an Australian radio program?
I think that's correct.
Yeah. And let's see. Dr. Mitchell, 77, said during a radio interview that sources at the space agency who had contact with aliens described the beings as little people who look strange to us. He said supposedly real-life ETs were similar to the traditional image of a small frame, large eyes, and head. Quote, I happen to have been privileged enough to be in on the fact that we've been visited on this planet and the UFO phenomena is real, Dr. Mitchell said. It's been well covered up by all our governments for the last 60 years or so, but slowly it's leaked out and some of us have been privileged to have been briefed on some of it. So, it's one of those, I had the notion that he had kind of hinted at things along these lines in the past. But, like I say, that's a pretty bold statement. And, frustratingly, he doesn't offer anything to really back it up. And
well, he's one of these well-traveled worldly men who have interacted with a wide variety of dignitaries, heads of state, military, big industry types, and again, all the while fomenting and trafficking in parapsychological mind-body research and researchers. And I remember it may have been, 4 years ago or 3 or 4 years ago, I attended a all-day seminar with Hal Puthoff, who's the person that was doing the remote viewing research out at Stanford that I alluded to earlier, and it was an all-day workshop dealing with psychic remote viewing and parapsychological research in general. And at the end of the meeting, there was some question and answer period, and of course the subject of UFOs came up, and Hal, I would say, has more or less said he thinks that what Edgar Mitchell at that time, and this is what the reason I'm bringing it up, is at that time that was this story was circulating that Mitchell was about to go public in a big way, more than he had already, and he may have overseas at different conferences around the world, but it never really garnered this sort of attention over here. But so, you know, here's Hal, somebody who he's known. And I think Hal was actually asked about this rumor, and he was more or less saying that he thought the same was likely, though. And around this time, Hal had published a new article about the idea of the... that may be the reason these different intelligences might be visiting us is because of their interest in our culture, such as it is. But anyway, or our ability to come up with novel inventions and whatnot. But UFOs in the news a lot lately. The MUFON finally issued their report on the Stevensville UFO incident, and lo and behold, there were radar tracks. And what did they show? But this thing, this unidentified, showing, heading up in a beeline straight towards Bush's ranch. And I don't know if you recall, but I'm pretty sure on this show, and certainly at the local MUFON meetings, I and others commented that, well, isn't this up near Bush's ranch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I want to say Conroe, but I know that's not right.
Crawford.
Crawford, yeah. Crawford, thank you. Yeah, it was noted in several of the stories at the time that the President's Ranch was in close proximity to Stevensville. Yeah. And, you know, that's, I'd say, hardly an argument for intelligent control, but...
Unless they're trying to spook him. It's coming right at us! Okay, so this was, what's the source of this article from July 12th? Oh, yes, the Star Telegram, star-telegram.com. Radar tracked unidentified craft near Crawford Group's report says July 12th, and I like the other person's headline, Radar tracked Stephenville UFOs, direct path to Bush Ranch. Federal Aviation Administration radar appears to confirm the presence of unidentified aircraft on January 8th over the Stephenville, Dublin area, with at least one appearing to head toward President Bush's Crawford Ranch, the same night that dozens of people reported seeing UFOs, according to a report released Thursday by a national group that studies reports of unidentified flying objects. That would be MUFON, M-U-F-O-N. According to the Mutual UFO Network report, the FAA radar indicated that several craft were moving in the same compass direction and time frame as those sighted by Erath County residents. The craft were not military and did not have transponders that relay information about themselves to radar operators. Radar tracked a Crawford-bound craft for more than an hour, according to the MUFON report. Witnesses said they saw two large glowing amber lights, similar in size and color to the lights on the back of a school bus. The object seemed to be stationary or moving at speeds of less than 60 miles per hour most of the time, but at one point it accelerated to 532 miles per hour in 30 seconds, according to the report. It did not seem to reach the property. Quote, the object was traveling to the southeast on a direct course towards the Crawford Ranch, the report states. Again, this is over at star-telegram.com from July 12th. And there's been a couple of follow-up articles, including... a fellow lamenting the fact that this isn't getting more attention. The fact that, you know, here's clear evidence, you know, of a seeming unidentified that is seemingly a potential military threat. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find a...
Well, in a way, it bolsters the notion that these might, in fact, not be extraterrestrial craft at all, but simply super-secret aircraft of our own. Certainly, you would think an unidentified non-commercial aircraft heading straight for the Bush Ranch would provoke some kind of response, especially with a military base so close by.
Right. And then, of course, the military had said that, oh, yes, we did have... jets up that night, but there was no UFO, and the people must have mistaken either the jets for the UFO or commercial aircraft. Now, the other article is Tuesday, July 22nd, Radar Expert Laments Media Apathy by Billy Cox over at heraldtribune.com. This would be the Chicago Tribune. Glenn Schultz suspects the reason the military corrected its version of events over Stephenville, Texas on January 8th was that it knew his Freedom of Information Act request for radar data from civilian authorities at the FAA were going to expose the truth. Quote, 4 days after our FOIAs hit the FAA, they knew we'd show they had planes all over the place that night, Schultz says from his home in Littleton, Colorado. They didn't have much choice. Fort Worth radar data shows the F-16s from takeoff to landing at Carswell Air Force Base. I don't think Carswell wanted to explain why they'd deny it. At age 78, Schultz brought an impressive career to bear in the Mutual UFO Network Special Research Report released July 10th on the UFO that surged towards restricted airspace over President Bush's Crawford Ranch 7 months ago. In the 1950s, Schultz received a Special Army commendation for upgrading missile tracking antenna sites for the White Sands Proving Grounds. Oh, boy. The following decade, he delivered a revelation to America's intelligence agencies by recording Soviet radar signals bouncing off the lunar surface into receivers on Antigua. Schultz went on to specialize in the radar return analysis of air traffic accident investigations and has been called as an expert witness by law firms handling aviation litigation. Awesome. So he's one of the co-writers of this report, along with Robert Powell. And I'm wondering if... I don't remember. I think that Robert Powell sounds familiar from another recent report that dealt with abduction data. But anyway, another interesting article that came out at the same time as... or a couple days after the report. Nope, that's not the right one. Where did I put it? Oh, yes, NARCAP plus MUFON equals deja vu, and this is by the same author, actually, Billy Cox. And this is July 15th, and this mentions our friend Patrick Hui. In 2002, with the U.S. still jangled from 9/11, Patrick Hui wrote a piece for Fate magazine about the UFO sightings over Carteret, I'm not sure if that's Carteret, New Jersey, on the early morning of July 15th, 2001. The mesmerizing lights had no transponders, were tracked by FAA radar at Newark International Airport, and more than 100 witnesses were identified, many of them motorists, who paused for a look-see along the New Jersey Turnpike. Back then, Huige, the veteran freelancer and author who broke the New York Times story about UFOs scoping nuclear weapon sites at Air Force bases in Loring, Maine, Malmstrom, Montana, Minot, South Dakota, and Wurstsmith, Michigan in the autumn of 1975, and I didn't know that, was relatively upbeat about prospects for a break in the weather, and meaning he was thinking there'd be more UFO reports. After years of laboring in journalism's ghetto, Huige was certain the media wouldn't have ignored the Carteret sightings had they occurred immediately after the Twin Towers went down. He wrote about how post-9/11 diligence regarding violations of U.S. airspace, quote, may foreshadow the future of UFO investigations in the United States, unquote. And he says, boy, Huige says, laughing from his home in Westchester, New York, was I wrong about that? Now editor-in-chief of Anomalous Books, Huige is impressed by MUFON's just-released study on the January 8th UFO incident over Stephenville, but between the military's unwillingness or inability to provide radar data from its jet fighters and the media's indifference to the national security issues raised by MUFON's meticulously detailed report, do we count Larry King since nothing ever comes of his stuff? Huige seen it all before. Once again, an unidentified aircraft tracked on FAA radar over a populated area without transponders, just like Carteret, he says. And the article goes on, and it's a really good article. I really
I also recommend it. This is www.heraldtribune.com/article/oh holy mackerel.
That yeah, no, it's just no, it's just NARCAP plus MUFON equals Deja Vu by Billy Cox. And it is the headline, and that'll get you there. Plus, we're going to link to all these articles at the website.
That's an easy to remember, precognitivedissonance.com. Still on the previous article that we were talking about, Radar Expert Laments.
Uh-huh.
And there's a small chart. It's actually a reproduction of the radar trace of the unknown object. And there's a couple of figures on there that I think bear mentioning. It's basically just a fairly straight dotted line across graph paper that shows the map coordinates, but none of the underlying terrain. From 98 degrees 5 minutes to 90, about an arc of 1 degree of latitude and longitude is what's represented. And the note, 7:32 p.m., possible rapid acceleration to 532 miles per hour in 30 seconds and then decelerates to 49 miles per hour 10 seconds later.
Yeah.
That was the rapid acceleration is one thing, but the even more rapid deceleration, especially to a speed at which a conventional jet fighter would simply fall out of the sky.
It would become an expensive rock.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever it was not a conventional aircraft.
One more thing from this NARCAP MUFON article. There's a great quote of a pretty incensed Patrick here, I think. You've got a Homeland Security Department that considers itself above the law. They don't have to answer to anybody, and the media doesn't really care. This story has got no legs at all. It's not going anywhere. And it's like there you can just hear the frustration there that so many of us, I think, feel about. It's like, you know, there's obviously some political overtones there that I completely empathize with and agree with. But, you know, that article mentions Patrick breaking the story about the UFO military nuclear weapon site incursions at Loring, Maine, Malmstrom, Minot, and Wurstsmith. And, you know, Larry King has been doing a lot of UFO stuff lately, and over at AnomalyTV.com, my pal Floyd Anderson posted, are UFOs interfering with missile systems? Some videos he found online. It's a five-part video series of clips. Each is probably about 6 to 10 minutes long. Obviously, I don't want to play that much of it, but just here's a little sample.
I don't think this is the clip.
I think I queued up the wrong thing. Okay, well, that's cool. That was some fun music and some cool visuals, but y'all weren't hearing anybody talking about military nuclear weapons intrusions. Anyway, so, what else is in the news? I grouped a bunch of UFO stuff together there.
Let's see, was that the...
I was trying to play the video from Larry King, where he has on, it's from July 18th, 2008,
yeah.
Guests included Robert Hastings, Bob Salas, Bob Jameson, Bob Jacobs, oh gosh, yep.
I'm bringing up the link.
Bill Nye, Stanton Friedman, James Fox, and Seth Shostak. Yeah, that first video I think is just a video, and I was playing the wrong thing, but anyway, so, to hell with that.
Okie dokie, then.
Well, we had a lot of other cryptozoology news, too.
Oh, yes. More controversy. An outfit out of Georgia, was it, was saying that they had a Bigfoot body that was going to be unveiled. Initially, September 1st, and... then Lauren Coleman says they sort of changed the date to October 1st, and further skullduggery has come to light.
Well, they were releasing information on the web about this on YouTube videos, where they were basically talking about having acquired a body and that hinting that it had been brought down with a bullet, but not really going into any details about who had shot it or anything like that, and saying that they weren't releasing any pictures or images of it until they had successfully talked to a lawyer about how to go about this. And most people were rightfully going, well, you know, maybe, slimmest possibility. But all the while, these guys were like, you know, hawking T-shirts and, and seemingly not that crazily over the top like I would think if somebody had actually got one of these things. And then, of course, it gets even stranger when they start pulling their own videos off the net and putting out new ones and sort of progressing this sort of a story, at which point they introduce a character going by the name of, was it Dr. Paul von Buren? Von Buren?
I think so.
And, they released some video of him getting off an airplane and you know, talking about his time being, of course, very in large demand, and his time being very important. And apparently, very quickly, people figure out that, wait a minute, that's that guy's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And strangeness of strange, he apparently is here in Austin. And I think the video footage was even shot at the Austin International Airport. So I'm actually thinking we should try to call this guy and get him on the show and say, hey, what are you doing here?
Oh, well, you know, it's a notion. Let's see. Just skimming through the posts and whatnot.
This is from the video, folks. Yeah, Dr. Paul Van Buren.
You know, just a couple quick things I want to go over. There's a couple of very good points I'd like to make. First of all, Just a message to all the people who've been calling, threatening us. You know, there's people who've taken this over the top. People have actually called, threatened to kill us, do harm to us. We're going to start recording the phone calls, okay? And we're going to start
tracking. You killed Bigfoot!
We're going to start tracking you down and prosecuting you for the death threats. Totally unnecessary. Competition's competition, and the Bigfoot world is apparently real competitive. But we're not going to deal with the threats anymore.
They put a BFRO
logo. One other thing that might be interesting for you guys to know is, of all the Bigfoot discussions and all the critiques we've been receiving, no one's actually came up with anything valid. You know, something interesting, one of the most interesting things that I'm going to reveal to you right now is this is a male. And a lot of people haven't ever thought about that. When they make their fake Bigfoot suits and do all this other stuff, they don't think about gender. All they're thinking about is making money. This is the male we've got right here.
All right. Anyway, well,
well,
you know.
That makes it almost a moral imperative for someone to produce a corpse. No, most Bigfoot hoaxers don't think about that sort of thing.
But we did. Is that what he's saying? apparently he's I think he's a cop. In all these videos, he's got his hand in a contraption because I think he was shot in the hand by a suspect. Right before these videos were shot.
Bigfoot had a gun?
No. He was a cop and he was trying to arrest somebody. At least that's the impression one gets from the. First video I saw of this whole shenanigans.
Well,
I call shenanigans.
Something tells me it's not gonna increase anybody's respect for local law enforcement in the South. But I gotta give Lauren credit. He seems to be willing to, you know, wait till October 1st, even though apparently these fellows have slammed him. And I think they were dissing the book he did with Patrick a while back.
Field
Guide to North American... not the Field Guide to North American Monsters. I believe that was a different author. But I think we'll have the title up here in just a second.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on it. but yeah, it's one of their co-written books, and it's a field guide, so shouldn't be that hard to find online.
Well, it's referenced in a previous article at Cryptomundo.
Well,
what we're looking at, by the way, folks, is Bigfoot Body Brouhaha.
Brouhaha.
Points for alliteration.
Bigfoot Body on C2C, Coast to Coast. Lauren Coleman was reporting on Matt Moneymaker going on Coast to Coast with George Noory. That's actually a different article that I'm looking at. Field Guide to Bigfoot and Other Mystery Primates, Lauren Coleman and
Dick. That's it.
Yeah.
Yes, they apparently...
I've gotten some insider information in the last couple of weeks that there are several, at least one Bigfoot research organization of note has been discussing internally whether to, how to deal with the sort of the increasing wackiness of certain researchers out there like, Biscardi, and then these jokers. Other groups, and other people that get into the psychic Sasquatch stuff, and I was actually glad to learn that the group in question, which I'm not mentioning specifically, were having a dialogue about how best to deal with other groups or researchers that many in that group might feel are just like you say, making it harder for legitimate, more down-to-earth scientific groups to do what they're trying to do.
Yeah, well, as with the ufological field,
the
noise-to-signal ratio is definitely skewing in favor of noise.
And so they're troubled by should they denounce, should they actually put out public statements one way or the other saying how they come down on some of this stuff, or should they just distance themselves? Or and I think typically they should probably distance themselves, but at the same time, it's kind of like our past guest Paul Kimball said, you know, there are two aspects of ufology. There's the circus, which is fun and entertaining, and then there's the serious side, and it's awesome if they can coexist.
Well,
and I'm not sure if they can.
I'm reminded that Shoemaker Levy striking Jupiter was awesome. and interesting in the Chinese sense, but there's another post from today, I believe, love letter to Cryptomundo. Lauren takes it, I won't say tongue in cheek, but definitely not terribly seriously. There's a smiley emoticon at the end of the short post and a link to yet another scathing video in which they apparently continue to criticize Cryptomundo, a.k.a. Wacko World, or something like that. but Wade Lawrence's book, Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America, around, which will probably not hurt sales at all. And closes with the comment, "My only hope is that the computer Officer Witten uses to write his police reports or his forthcoming groundbreaking new book has a spell checker." Apparently, it's not terribly grammatically correct, or not proofread before publication.
Well, Lauren's also been reporting on a DNA test for Yeti hair over Cryptomundo, and there's I think the link to the article there that goes to BBC News, scientists to test Yeti hairs, and there's been this recent WashingtonCityPaper.com article, Hot for Creature, which I've had Hot for Teacher going through my head for days and ever since I saw that headline.
You know, that's one of those songs that I have absolutely no trouble forgetting about.
Never
a terribly big Van Halen fan.
I'll forgive you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's just, I have seen the video once, and there's one brief clip where Eddie Van Halen leans right into the camera with what I can only describe as a shit-eating grin.
Oh, yes.
And it's just like, oh. Then, you know, it just drives all thought to the film from my mind. yes, here we go. Scientists to test Yeti hair. Oh, this is from the reports that have been coming out of northern India. There's an interesting artist's interpretation. The head of the article makes the creature look a little bit more like a baboon than anything.
This is the BBC one. Yeah, yeah.
Considerably more erect than a baboon, but scientists at Oxford will perform a microscopic analysis on Thursday before it is taken to Bristol, where a DNA test will be performed. The little-known Indian version of the legendary ape-like creature is called Mande Barung, or Forest Man, and is reputed to live in the remote West Garo Hills of the northeastern state of Meghalaya. Meghalaya. And this is fairly recent that these reports have been coming out. I can't remember if there's anything like it from Sanderson or any of the later works or not. But hopefully something will come of it.
I think there's something by or about Sanderson in the New Fate magazine. I was reading about over at anomalist.com, where, of course, we get a lot of these headlines. The July-August 2008 Fate magazine, it's now a bi-monthly schedule. Latest issue contains Strange Tales from the London Underground by Nick Redfern. sounds interesting. I'm always up for chud and underground weirdness. Visiting the Land of the Stone Giants by Carl Schuker, and Ivan Sanderson by Kurt Southerly. So I guess it's about Ivan by this author. Kurt Southerly, does that ring any bells?
A vague one. Let's see. No, there's the article is just sampled at Fate's site. There's a picture of Mr. Sanderson from his younger days. It's a reminiscence.
Well, we certainly do that often enough, don't we?
Yeah. Well, he's one of those people that I regret not getting the chance to meet. I believe he died in 1976, and I had only been aware of his work for three or four years prior to that, you know, and is just graduating high school that year. But,
and I wasn't much aware of anything because I was still a wee little tot.
Yes, indeed. You were on the tiny side. But
like, kind of like that lemur in this picture. Or whatever that is.
I think that is a lemur.
Some kind of ring tail, something or other?
Interesting. Well, a pronounced white mask on its face. Sanderson is one of those problematic individuals in the field. He was a well-known and highly regarded nature writer. Seems to have had an interest in the cryptozoological and, for that matter, the Fortean fairly early on, but doesn't really become known for it until later in his life, the last 20 years or so, from the late 40s up into the 70s, time of his death. And it's been demonstrated on more than one occasion that he could either get it fabulously wrong or was simply, in a number of cases, making stuff up.
Oh.
my favorite is still the chapter from the book Things, which was definitely one of my formative influences in terms of getting me interested in Fortiana. But there's a chapter in it called Old Three Toes about some tracks and sightings in Central Florida in the late 40s. And out of all this, he spun the notion of a surviving prehistoric penguin 15 feet tall, and that these tracks could not be made by anything that weighed less than, I think, 2 or 3 tons, or a machine 50 feet tall that some engineering friends of his came up with. And, of course, I think we've talked about it on the show a couple of times in the past. In the late 90s, a very old gentleman said, well, no, we just made these concrete shoes and walked down the beach in them. And he had the original concrete shoes that he and I believe either a friend or his brother had cooked up in their garage and went strolling down the beach with. Now, you know, the tracks were definitely seen. Apparently they were never photographed. I've never seen anything in the literature other than the description of them. But around the same time, there were sightings of something in, I want to say it's the Pensacola River, somewhere in the Tampa Bay area, on the Gulf Coast of Florida. But beyond that, I don't really, well, anyway, I'm rambling, and the point is that, you know, Sanderson could go out on a limb for the sake of something that sounded really good.
No, it was rather entertaining. As abduction researcher Carla Turner said to my friend Greg Bishop about John Keel, he's not afraid to invent evidence. Well, let's try this here. This is from the article Hot for Creature.
My sighting started, actually it was in 1995. I was metal detecting with two other friends, both with the FBI at the time. We had a great day of metal detecting down in Culpeper, Virginia. We spent a good morning and afternoon there, and on the way back, we were walking along the logging road, and one of the agents basically brought out his arms and said, "Stop," and he pointed his left finger on his shoulder, and he said, "From the tip of my finger, 75 feet in behind that tree is a man." Both the gentlemen grabbed their sidearms, pointed to that tree. About 3 seconds later, we had this creature peer out from behind the tree. I got behind the two agents. About 2 to 3 seconds later, this 7-foot-tall creature started running from our left to right. Pretty quick in its speed, didn't make any sound. It was running. You could see the large shoulders, muscles, everything. It was just an incredible sighting. It took a hard left turn, went down an embankment. We saw the back shoulder blades going back and forth, some discoloration in the hair color on the back. The whole sighting lasted about 12 seconds, but it's pretty much led me on this new hobby, which is pretty interesting.
This is Eric Wills with Washington City Paper. I found William Drangenis, as many people do, by coming across his website. Drangenis is the president of the Virginia Bigfoot Field Research Organization. Since he saw Bigfoot 13 years ago, he's been trying to track the creature down. He investigates other people's sightings. I went with Drangenis as he recently made a house call in Chesterfield County, just south of Richmond. He met with a man who described something banging on the kitchen window at night and crashing through the woods. And he had potential evidence. Bigfoot hair.
Take a look at it under the microscope?
Sure.
I can take some photographs of it too through the microscope and sort of compare it to what else is out there. Okay. Of known animals, also the possible Sasquatch hair we have.
Drangenis designed surveillance systems for the Windermere Group, an Annapolis-based technology company. He's got some fancy high-tech equipment to track Bigfoot down. At the man's house, Drangenis sets up a motion-activated camera. If Bigfoot wanders into the corner of the yard, Drangenis will capture him on tape. Drangenis has invented a new surveillance system that he thinks will revolutionize Bigfoot research. He calls the system I Gotcha. Once Drangenis figures out where the creature likes to hang out, he plans to do a stakeout with a DNA dart gun.
This is the DNA dart tip, which you can see is much larger. Lighting back. It's terrible around here. But the idea is it goes in into the body, takes a little sampling of the skin, the hair, blood also, and basically would get pushed into there, and some would come back into the tube, which is sterilized. Normally this holds the a charge and also the tranquilizer, so when it goes into the body, it would push it out into the creature and then fall off.
You may be among the skeptics who think Bigfoot is nothing more than a man in an ape suit, but Drangenis points to the evidence, the more than 200 sightings he's logged in Virginia, and the casts of Bigfoot prints. He's sure that one day, he'll find the creature and prove the doubters wrong.
You know, with the D.C. Newspaper, I'm not sure what type of response I may get out of this one where, you know, who knows? The men in black may be coming knocking at my door. Maybe some sightings will come from it. Past sightings, historical sightings from years ago. Maybe someone has footprint tracks they've been keeping for years in the basement and really never knew what to do with them.
And that's over from WashingtonCityPaper.com. Hot for creature. 13 years ago, William Drangenis saw Bigfoot, 50 grand, a van, and a camera and a log. Later, the quest continues. A camera and a log.
Yeah.
I've seen lots of video interviews with this guy, and he just seems really genuine, and he's obviously well-funded, and I think it's interesting that his first sighting was with some FBI agents. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Virginia, huh?
Well, it's one of the puzzling aspects of the search for Bigfoot, Sasquatch, call them what you like.
Wild man.
He seems to be everywhere and nowhere.
We
have our reports from East Texas. There are stories out of Oklahoma.
And even
of course, the classic
desert.
Pacific Northwest and Northern California sightings. Ohio has a wild man or a Bigfoot. Florida has the skunk ape. There have been sightings from Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, I believe.
I would venture to guess that there's at least one report in every state in the Union. What about Hawaii? What about Alaska?
Alaska, it's amazing that there haven't been reports. And that's, you know, it's also interesting in that you don't really get much, at least as far as I know, from North and Central Canada. Although there, you know, there was the big flap over the moderately interesting footage produced in Northeastern Canada just a couple of years ago. Yeah. But, yeah, it's one of those, you're talking on the one hand about an animal that is large, for one thing, seems to have a very significant range, but still, you know, nobody runs into one. Nobody sees one from an overpass or, you know, gets one on their cell phone crossing the highway.
Not yet.
Not yet. Fair enough.
Jumping back just briefly to UFOs, if you haven't heard, Jacques Vallée is back. he never really left, he's just been lurking. Lurking out of the scene of the circus of ufology for some time now, and thankfully the folks at Anomalist Books have reprinted his Alien Contact Trilogy, Dimensions, Confrontations, and Revelations, all three of which are excellent places for folks to start, or excellent places for people to go if they've never read his works before. Another reprint is the seminal Messengers of Deception, UFO Contacts and Cults from 1979. It's been republished by the publisher behind Daily Grail, a really great website for strange phenomena and consciousness type information. And just recently, one of the other shows on this network, Anomaly Radio, is the Tim Banal's show, BOA, Banal of America, and he just concluded his third season on the web radio, on the intertubes, with an interview with Jacques Vallée. And it's just about 2 hours long, and it's very interesting and excellent, as anything having to do with Vallée is, in my mind. So I highly recommend folks check that out. And Mac Tonies, who I've been wanting to have on Anomaly Radio soon, possibly as a guest for Precognitive Dissonance, is blogging over at SETI.com, and his latest is Do Flying Saucers Crash?
It's sort of a rhetorical question. I read it shortly before the show came on, and it posits that, yes, indeed they do, but it's on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, basically a way of surreptitiously slipping the natives, well, let's hope they're not infected horse blankets, but something along the lines of a small steam engine or a flashlight.
That they're slowly trying to get us up to their level so that maybe they can contact us overtly, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Although, why they would, you know, offer us pieces of technology rather than any kind of cultural interaction is interesting.
Maybe they have offered the cultural interaction, and that's what the abduction and contact reports are.
You know how I feel about that.
Well.
But contact reports, maybe. Abduction reports,
Yeah, here's our culture. Bend over.
Yeah.
That's a low blow. Don't you know?
I just had this vision of bearded aliens saying, "We're from Sparta!"
Purposefully crashed UFOs could also serve as a sort of invitation to officialdom, allowing the decision for open contact or simply official acknowledgement to be made by terrestrial leaders, an idea explored by Whitley Strieber in his fiction book Majestic. Yeah. Actually, I think Majestic is a really excellent speculative exploration of the Roswell incident in light of, you know, post-Roswell UFO phenomena, ufology in general. If you haven't read it, it's worth a read. One of my favorite scenes is when a bunch of military guys are sitting around a table discussing what they've grokked from, you know, dissecting and the technology and the beings, and somebody says, yeah, they apparently have a hive mind of collective intelligence, and of course one of the military guys says, does that mean they're communists?
Oh, dear. Oh.
Which, you know, hey, that was one of the early worries, I suspect, amongst UFO military researchers, was that if it wasn't an outright communist conspiracy, that you know, we don't know what these aliens, what kind of government they have.
Mm-hmm. And it was very much an unknown, you know, all the way around. And we had just discovered the power of the atom, so, you know, it was a time of tremendous uncertainty. A lot of things make a certain amount of sense, even if they aren't particularly palatable, or, you know, even at this date, even then, you know, not particularly ethical. But
hey, before we're getting down the last 8 minutes here, or so
yeah,
I wanted to mention that another past guest of Precognitive Dissonance, Walter Bosley, has a new. He had mentioned on our show that he was coming out with a new paranormal magazine, and lo and behold, it is now out. Of course, he's been publishing Lost Continent Library for a while now. That's got a lot of adventure fiction and very cool global exploration type stuff. But Phantom Stream is now available as a free download via mottimorphic.com. That's MOTTIMORPHIC.com. Somewhere there should be a link there, and we're going to post a link on the website. Special edition of a magazine is almost always a treat, quoting from anomalous.com, but it's even more so when the special edition comes, even for a limited time, without a price tag. This new magazine is available in a PDF for download with articles by such heavy hitters on the high strangeness stage as Brad Steiger, Walter Bosley, Richard Sennett, Greg Bishop, William Michael Mott, and Kevin Jones. Not to be missed. I recently was picking through this article by Brad Steiger, is Lost Between Time and Space. There's an excerpt of a chapter from the book by Walter Bosley about the thing he was alluding to at the end of the interview. A chapter from the controversial book Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom. An investigation of evidence that occult science and technology were built into Disneyland reveals ghosts in the realm. And I think Greg contributed some ideas to that. And a bunch of other good stuff in there. So I might want to download that while it's still there and available for free, as well as the editions of Lost Continent Library.
It's a very attractive presentation. Greg Bishop has an article called The Middle Ground, Close Encounters of the Non-Humanoid Kind.
Of course, his website's excludedmiddle.com. And, yeah, there's a picture of him there. I guess that must be the Kill Radio studio out there in L.A. or thereabouts, where they used to do...
Undisclosed location.
Yeah, used to do micro-FM broadcasting, but now I think it's purely internet radio, which, of course, again, is carried on Anomaly Radio Sunday nights, 10 to midnight. So what about this this killer weed, dude?
I don't know nothing about that stuff.
The article over at alternet.org, Synthetic Pot as a Military Weapon? Meet the Man Who Ran the Secret Program, by Martin A. Lee, Alternet. Dr. James Ketchum tested a potent form of synthetic marijuana on soldiers to develop a secret weapon in the 60s. Now he's telling the tale. It was billed as a panel discussion on, quote, the global shift in human consciousness. A half-dozen speakers had assembled inside the heebie-jeebies healer's tent at Burning Man, the annual post-hippie celebration in Black Rock, Nevada, where 50,000 stalwarts braved intense dust storms and flash floods last August. Among the notables who spoke at the early evening forum was Dr. Alexander Sasha Shulgin, the Bay Area-based psychochemical genius, much beloved among the burners, who synthesized ecstasy and 200 other psychoactive drugs and tested each one on himself during his unique offbeat career. Sitting on the panel next to Shulgin was an unlikely expositor. Dr. James S. Ketchum, a retired U.S. Army colonel, told the audience, quote, "When Sasha was trying to open minds with chemicals to achieve greater awareness, I was busy trying to subdue people." Ketchum was referring to his work at Edgewood Arsenal, headquarters of the U.S. Army Chemical Corps in the 1960s, when America's national security strategists were high on the prospect of developing a non-lethal, incapacitating agent, a so-called humane weapon that could knock people out without necessarily killing anyone. Top military officers hyped the notion of war without death, conjuring visions of aircraft swooping over enemy territory, releasing clouds of madness gas that would disorient the bad guys and dissolve their will to resist, while U.S. soldiers moved in and took over. Now, this article, I think, goes on to describe the effects of some of this stuff, where it literally, basically, the people were just so giddy with, you know, unspecific joy and a sense of inertia so powerful that one person, when asked if they found themselves in a burning building, what would they do, and the person was like, "I'd just sit there and watch it because it would be just too entertaining," or something like that. And it reminded me of the drug from the movie Serenity that, as an attempt to end war, mm-hmm. ends up causing half the people to become violent berserker zombie type cannibal freakazoids, and the other half to just kind of lie where they are until they die because they just are so at ease or content or something.
Much like the classic Wirehead of science fiction. It's a clever turn of phrase in here. Ketchum was into weapons of mass elation, not weapons of mass destruction. Article goes on. It's a fairly technical article in that it talks at some length about the chemical formulas and the processes used to arrive at these things. Apparently they started with what was essentially a concentrated form of hash oil, which I seem to recall is basically marijuana boiled down to a combination of resin and oil that's extremely concentrated. Hashish is, of course, you know, a more concentrated form of marijuana. And, this was two or three steps beyond that, and then they went on with this synthetic, which was several orders of magnitude stronger yet. One of the most interesting aspects of it was apparently the longevity of the effect. It talks about people being under the effects of this stuff for 30 hours at a stretch.
You get.
Yeah. that's normally something that you hear more in connection with things like the hallucinogens, and
yeah.
even there, LSD, you're talking about 12, 14 hours.
Gosh. That's, that's not
definitely good. Looks like, and of course, as always, the comments are worth looking at. The very first one, the American military is a threat to mankind. There is no good outcome having a military like the U.S. military. It's time to stop funding their insanities and their potentials to kill. Well, you know, it's good to have goals.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Craig, any final comments before we wrap up for the evening?
Nothing comes to mind except to say thanks for listening, folks, and please visit the website, www.precognitivedissonance.com. Drop us a line, leave us a comment. We now have a toll-free 1-800 number you can call during the show. That's 1-800-513-0105. And we'll see you all next week.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. This has been Smiles Lewis and Craig Gork on Precognitive Dissonance Live via Anomaly Radio for joining us. And tune in next week, 8 to 9 p.m. Thursday evening, all right? All right.
Radio, keep watching the seas.